Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
So, we're going to segue here from cases that the Justice Department is dropping to cases that some of the state attorney generals and DAs and prosecutors may be bringing. It is reported that there are two investigations going on of President Trump and his actions. And one is in New York and one is in Georgia. And in Georgia, it appears it has to do with his discussions with Secretary of State Raffenberger and whether or not he tried to suborn or influence changes in vote outcomes illegally. And I don't want to talk about that because that is at least colorable and is an actual crime that everyone can recognize. And so I don't know enough about it to have concerns about it. But one of the issues that we always have with prosecutions and whether cases are being brought properly is whether they are being brought because of neutral enforcement priorities or if they're being brought for perhaps other reasons. And the reason the New York investigations are somewhat problematic are there's a number of reasons. One of them is, Mark, it appears they're bringing in some private guns on this one.
Yeah, yes, that's right. Mark Pomerantz from Paul Weiss, I believe, was the name I saw that the Manhattan DA's office is bringing in to help go after former President Trump on the taxes issue, and I believe not just him, but I think this extends to Trump Enterprises or what the various business entities are called as well.
Right. And so Cyrus Vance Jr., who's the former Secretary of State's son, is the DA of New York. He's elected and he takes over for another son of a famous Morgenthau, who was the previous prosecutor for many years till he was a very, very old man. And so Vance may want to make a name for himself by prosecuting Trump. And the reason that this has some red flags around it, it seems to me, is that Trump was a New Yorker for 40 years doing all kinds of Trumpy things. And now that he was president and they didn't like what he did, they canceled all his contracts like the Woolman Rink, which is a skating rink in New York that he's run for all these years after bringing back. They're canceling all the city contracts and all. That's perfectly fine if they want to do that. But prosecution is a different thing. We want to think that our prosecutions are brought in this country because you find a crime or a possible crime and you investigate it. You don't want to be like Stalin and, you know, find me the man and I'll find you the crime. And the reason this comes up is that Trump has been in New York doing real estate. I don't know if any of you folks saw Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield, but there's a famous scene in Back to School where he is a longtime businessman in New York running retail stores, but he goes to an economics class at a very Tony school as an older middle-aged man, and the economics professor is starting to talk about how businesses work. And Rodney says, well, wait a minute, who'd you pay off to get the building permit? and he starts going in to all the sort of hinky things that happen when you're in real estate and construction. And he's from New York, obviously. But in any event, so there's all kinds of things that I presume one could have investigated Trump for. And he's been in tons of civil suits in both he and his companies for 30, 40 years. I read, I think in Atlantic, somewhere like this, that it's over 3,000 suits that he or his companies have been involved in. That's just incredible. But, I mean, we're both lawyers. I don't think we've been in 3,000 suits since.
not even close. Yeah.
So the thing is, So it's a huge amount of scrutiny that's come in. And if a prosecution is brought, I think one of the defenses will be that it's, you know, it's politically motivated. But what you really don't want, I think, both in the administrative law context and certainly whenever criminal laws is there, is you don't want the perception, and that I think the juries would be very upset about it, no matter what their political backgrounds, that this is only being brought because this you don't like this politician. And that's going to be part of any defense if the case is brought. But you have two sides of the problem, Mark. You have the problem of, is it politicized? And then you have the problem of, well, wait a minute. If you bring a suit and you lose, let's say you're bringing it on some sort of corruption or bribery or tax fraud, you don't want to lose a suit like that, because then you create precedent and you give the view to all the folks out there who might be deciding to do it that they can get away with it. So I just hope that if these prosecutions, to the extent they go forward, are very solidly based and aren't done in order to pump up somebody's reputation. Because as the fella you talked about, look, he'll never have to buy drinks in New York again if he convinced Trump, right?
Well, and yeah, I think that's right. And I don't know Mark Pomerantz, and Paul Weiss is obviously a very well thought of firm. I assume that Mark Pomerantz has an excellent reputation as well. So I'm not trying to cast aspersions on him in any way, except to say that I'm just bothered in general of bringing in these hired guns. I don't know what the profits per partner are at Paul Weiss, but if it's like the other white shoe New York firms, it's well in excess of $1 million a year. And so he's giving that up to come in and take over this particular prosecution. Well, you want to have a disinterested prosecutor. If someone's given up, even if he's being paid whatever New York DAs are paid, I'm sure he's giving up at least $800,000 a year. And by the way, if he's not giving up his firm salary at the same time he's doing this, that might create other conflicts of interest and other problems. But let's assume he's giving it up. So now he has this financial stake in the outcome of the litigation, because he's given up something quite substantial in order to do this. And that's a concern. Now, if you might say, well, people do that all the time. They give up these big prestigious law firm jobs in order to go take a job as the secretary of this or that or the other thing in the administration. Well, that's true, but they're not doing that for the purpose of going after one person, right? That they're doing that for a broad portfolio. But if you do this for one person, it's very much reminiscent to me, Vec, of like the independent counsel statute or something like that, except at the local level here.
Exactly. And that is a problem. And I agree with you about both Paul Weiss and a partner, certainly if he wants to serve, should serve. I mean, if he wanted to go off and be a DA, we wouldn't think one way or another. But if you've come out to get the man, and this was really the problem with the independent prosecutor statute of the 80s and 90s, which went away, that Scalia's famous dissent in Morrison v. Olson has pretty much become the view. Look, if you devote all these resources and one person to getting one guy, how can he actually look at it and then say, nope, nothing here? The only guy who I'm pretty sure did that is Jake Stein, God rest his soul, was the special prosecutor for Meese. And he looked at the whole thing and then he just said this, I presume he said, because he dropped the case, that there was no, there was no reason to prosecute Meese in those circumstances. But if he had been a different kind of man and a different kind of lawyer, he wouldn't have done that for his own interior reasons, that he wants to at least have a prosecution. And you got to be a special kind of person to not have those internal drives once you've been picked.
Yeah, I think that's right. The other thing that this brings to mind is the lawsuits that were brought by the local district attorney in Austin, Texas, against Rick Perry, Governor Perry of Texas, when he was running for president. And then I can't remember if those extended into when he was the energy secretary or not.
Yes. And they also did it against the former Speaker of the House, the other Texas politician.
Jim Wright?
Jim. No, not Jim Wright.
Wrong. Yeah.
the Republican, same thing. He was on Dancing with the Stars. I'm forgetting his name right now.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking about.
But okay. You're absolutely right. And those were political prosecutions. They went nowhere, but you got the headline for the accusations, and the prosecutor got, a lot of attaboys from the people who didn't like Perry or didn't like other Republicans. It was bad news. So I hope that isn't what's happening. And you know what? Perhaps we will be proved wrong, and maybe they'll find nothing and say, you know what? We're not going to go forward with this, and we're going to make a prosecutorial decision that if there is whatever there is it doesn't rise to criminality or doesn't rise to the level of bringing suit. Or the other thing is they better have the goods. It better be a slam dunk type case. Because those two outcomes would at least make it a little more palatable.
But yeah, Tom DeLay is the guy you were talking about.
Tom DeLay, there you go. He was a boogeyman for a while, and they brought that case, and he was not found guilty. But of course, he was tied up and had to resign, and all these other things happened. So I do think that, and those were by state prosecutors as well. And that's another thing. You don't want presidents from states that didn't vote for them being prosecuted by them. Trump's a unique individual in that he has these business interests all over creation. So he can always be, you can always investigate him for something, I suppose. But it would be a bad precedent if highly ideological prosecutors are just looking for a crime for a guy they don't like. I mean, that you don't want to give that impression, and you don't want to have that reality. Let's hope there's something there, but I have just not seen. Oh, we're looking into, was his nonprofit properly run? So I don't know. Are his taxes okay? Well, you could do that. So let's hope.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here. And I just wanted to tell our audience, Vec, that they should feel free to jump on to nclalegal.org or ncla.legal. Those both take you to the same website where they can learn all about the different cases that the New Civil Liberties Alliance is bringing. They can watch videos of some of our cases, and they can learn about upcoming events like the luncheon law that we had earlier this week with Lisa Malise. Or at least about the Lisa Malise case. We had our colleague Jared McLean, one of the attorneys at NCLA, interview someone from a university professor and then someone from the public citizen organization who happened to file an amicus brief in that case. And you may be saying, public citizen, what are they doing filing an amicus brief in a New Civil Liberties Alliance case? Well, let's tell you about this case. I think you'll find it very interesting. The case is Malise v. Consumer Product Safety Commission. And the issue is, and in fact, this is something I found out about the general problem, not the specific problem, but the general problem of keeping rules behind paywalls is something I found out about when I was working at the CPSC. And so what's happened with Lisa Malise is that she wanted to look into the information about a bath seat that she was going to purchase. She is a new mom and has a baby and wanted to purchase the bath seat. And she saw that there were some safety issues on the website, on the CPSC's website, and that they had a safety standard. And she wanted to look a little bit more into, well, what are the particulars of this safety standard so that she could help have an informed decision about her purchase of this seat. And what she found out was that she couldn't access the safety standard. It was behind a paywall. In fact, she had to go to a third-party site. The ASTM is the name of the standard writing organization that owns the copyright to to the standard. And she had to go there and pay almost twice as much as the cost of a bath seat in order to obtain access to that standard, Vec. And she thought, well, that doesn't seem right. And so she has teamed up with the New Civil Liberties Alliance to sue the CPSC over this problem. And it's a widespread problem, not just at the CPSC, but across the government, of having laws behind paywalls. And you may remember, Vec, the stories from ancient Rome. I think it's Suetonius who tells the story of was it Caligula who wrote the law in really small type at the top of a tall column.
The rule was that you had to publish the law in public before you could prosecute someone about it. That was the rule in Rome. So this is what the emperor did, and I think you're right.
Yes. Yeah. So you put it in really small type at the top of a tall column that no one can actually read. Well, that's not reasonable access, and the federal law in the United States requires reasonable access to the law. And so the question in this particular lawsuit is, does it count as reasonable access to the law to require somebody to pay to see the law? And one of the responses that the agency has is, well, you don't have to pay to see the law. We have a reading room in Bethesda, Maryland, at the headquarters of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And besides that, there's a federal archive in Washington, D.C., which is very close to Bethesda, Maryland. So for all of you in the rest of the 50 states of the United States, now, feel free to fly in or drive in to Bethesda, Maryland or Washington, D.C. to take a look at this standard, which they will allegedly show to you. Vec, I have a feeling if you showed up at the National Archives and you asked to see a copy of the baby bath standard, that they would look at you like you had three heads. This is not how it works in the real world. In fact, we, in anticipation of this lawsuit, contacted the CPSC on more than one occasion. Our client did. Lisa Melise, and one of our lawyers did as well, to gain access to the reading room at the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And we were told on the phone, no such thing exists. There is no reading room. You can't actually come here. Don't come here, in fact, especially during the pandemic. Don't come here. We don't have something for you to look at. Those original calls were in, I think, early February of last year. So it was before any of the pandemic shutdown. So they just didn't have a reading room. So they said that they did in the rule, but they didn't actually at the time that the rule was passed have a reading room. And even if they have one today, Vec, do you think that's reasonable access to require somebody to come to Washington, D.C.? I mean, a plane ticket would cost more than the cost of just paying to purchase the standard itself.
Well, I'm shocked on a number of levels about that, because I've done research at the National Archives and I've been in a reading room there. And it, you know, when you want to go get... In the old days, now they're on rail, but you had to go listen to the Nixon tapes. They'd give you a place to go do it. And so that's number one. But number two, I am a specialized attorney who lives in D.C. I mean, come on. It's ridiculous, especially in this day and age. It's unbelievable that they'd make you go through those hoops. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's shocking. And yet the agency is unapologetic about it. In fact, there's kind of a ironic twist in the case. So Lisa Melise lives in Pennsylvania. And so naturally, under the statute, if you want to challenge one of these safety rules, and that's what NCLA is doing. We're actually challenging the safety rule itself because it was promulgated, we're saying, unlawfully by putting it behind a paywall. And so we don't want the safety standard to necessarily disappear forever. We're not challenging substantively the content of that standard. We're just saying that it needs to be, if they're going to do it, if they're going to make it mandatory, first of all, for the manufacturers to follow and for consumers to be aware of, then it has to be available for people to see. It used to be the case, and I'll come back to the ironic twist in a second, but it used to be the case that this wasn't a problem because prior to 2008, a lot of these safety standards were not mandatory. You had to, if you wanted to say on your package that conforms with ASTM standard, what have you, then that was something between you and ASTM. It'd be like the organic designation on milk, or if something is Oregon Tilth, or or some of the kosher designations that you see on foods, right? These things are not government sponsored. They are, they're private designations. And it used to be that way. And a lot of the safety standards at the CPSC for some of these consumer products were just weren't mandatory. And one of the reasons given for not making them mandatory is that the standards can change much more quickly. And if you make them mandatory, one of the things that happens is they tend to get a little bit ossified over time, right? They aren't changed as rapidly as they are if they're not mandatory. So arguably, there's a safety problem with making them mandatory as well. But there's definitely this rule of law problem, and that's what this case is about, and that's what we're talking about today. So what's the ironic twist? Well, here it is. As I say, Lisa Melise lives in Pennsylvania, so we under the statute, you can challenge these rules directly in the Court of Appeals. You do not have to go to the federal trial court with your initial challenge. So we went to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, which is the circuit that oversees Pennsylvania and Delaware and New Jersey, and we challenged the rule. And the agency responded to that, and they had one little just paragraph saying, you know, this might not be the right venue for this lawsuit. And we thought, well, that's curious. I wonder why they think that. Well, the Third Circuit did too, so they ordered briefing on this jurisdiction issue. And the position of the agency is that that these cases can only be brought in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. They can't be brought in the Third Circuit or any of the other regional circuit courts of appeals. So now we're in a position, Vec, where in order for Lisa Melise to challenge the fact that she has to go to Washington, D.C. to read the safety standard, she now has to go to Washington, D.C. to sue the agency in order to, and win in order to be able to read the safety standard someplace other than Washington, D.C. So how's that hit you?
Exactly. So now she has it's ridiculous. The federal government is everywhere. It runs the court system. The idea that the federal government gets to pick its venue on something like this is just so awful for any person, any, you know, subject, basically, rather than citizen, it sounds like. I mean,
well, and with all due respect to the Third Circuit, they're just wrong on this jurisdictional question. And I they should have at least allowed oral argument on it, because I think we could have set them straight. The original statute that was passed in 2008 did give exclusive jurisdiction to the D.C. Circuit, but only for the very first safety standards that were put out in 2008. So for each time, so like the very first bath seat standard would have applied to, or the very first crib standard, or the very first sling standard, what have you, all the different children's consumer product safety standards. But this wasn't this safety standard we're challenging wasn't the original. It was one of the subsequent revisions to the standard. And there's nothing in the statute that says that those revisions need to be challenged in D.C. In fact, it says that once these first rules are passed, then they will be treated as product safety rules. And part of being treated as a product safety rule going forward is that they can be challenged in other places. So I think we're now in the position of having to go to the D.C. Circuit and try to get the D.C. Circuit to also say that, its jurisdiction isn't exclusive and maybe kick it back to the Third Circuit. But I will say there is good law in the D.C. Circuit on this paywalls issue. And if folks want to learn more about this, they should tune in. There was a luncheon law this week, as I said, at ncla.legal, where you can go to NCLA's YouTube channel. You can watch the whole hour plus long luncheon law about this interesting topic. And you'll find out about things like the $850 safety standard for bottled water, Vec.
Well,
go ahead.
Anyway, and so they so that in order, how much does a bottle of water cost?
A dollar, maybe.
Right. So in order to challenge the safety standard or even read what it might be, you have to basically pay the cost of 850 bottles of water.
That's right. That's right. So this is your government at work, keeping the law hidden from the American people. And we're trying to do something about it. And I think if we win this case, Vec, it's going to strike a blow, not just against the CPSC, not just for access to product safety standards, but really for access to the law government-wide. I think that this business of hiding law behind paywalls will go away at more agencies than just the CPSD.